Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Martin O'Neill came into Celtic Park amidst a blaze of publicity in the summer of 2000 and stated, quote unquote, "I will do everything in my power to bring success to this football club." 5 years, three league titles, two Scottish Cups and two League Cups later, it's without question that he achieved exactly that. Into the bargain, he also restored our credibility in Europe during an era which took us all the way to the FA Cup final and gave us memories which so many of us will never forget. Martin was on a rare visit back to Glasgow to speak of his new book on days like this and took some time to sit with us at the Celtic Exchange to share some very special memories of a life in football. Enjoy this interview with one of the most important characters in the modern history of Celtic. Martin, thanks for joining us here on the Celtic Exchange this afternoon. I know it's a busy time for you back in Glasgow. I'm sure it always is. Is it nice to be back in the city?
It is, really. Yeah, recognise it, which is good for a start. Strangely enough, you know, I probably wasn't in the city centre that often. You know, first year I came up here, I think I was a wee bit concerned because one of my daughters was going to be leaving school and going to a different school. And I was a wee bit worried in case the results might not go the right way and she might take a little bit of stick at school. So we went over to Edinburgh in that direction. Spent a year in rented accommodation. But after that, my daughter said, "Listen, Dad, you know, we're fine. We're really great. I can take the train back and forward. Why don't we buy a house in Glasgow?" Which is what we did over in the West End. And it was just genuinely magical time.
Mm-hmm.
I know I've said this before. It's worth saying again. My wife, who doesn't like any place on earth, I think, absolutely adored Glasgow.
Yeah, loads of fond memories over the 5 years or so here at Celtic. So what we'll do, Martin, obviously we're here talking about your first book. Is it the first of many or just the...
It's the first. The first and perhaps only.
Yeah, so Martin's book, On Days Like This, My Life in Football. And if you don't mind, Martin, in the same way as you've done with the book, what I'll do here this afternoon is split our conversation into two sections, Martin O'Neill the player, first of all, and then Martin O'Neill the manager. So before we get to Notts Forest and a place where you spent 10 years of your career, I want to take you back briefly to your time at Distillery Football Club in Belfast. Manager Jimmy McAlinden takes a real shine to you and you're going to score two goals in a 3-0 win in the Irish Cup final over your hometown team Derry City. Mixed emotions there, I'm sure. A result which then takes you into the Cup Winners' Cup and a game against Barcelona, no less. Despite losing the first leg, you score against them in a 3-1 defeat. It's your first taste of what would become a life of European football. Martin, what was that experience like, you know, playing against Barca, going to the Nou Camp, and did it whet your appetite for the numerous European nights that would follow throughout your career?
Yeah, well, a couple of ironies along the way, really, because for 5 years I'd been a boarder at a school in Derry City called St. Columb's. And obviously a lot of day boys went to the school. In my class was a player called Raymond White, or a young lad called Raymond White, very, very clever man. He was playing for Derry City, believe it or not, against me in the Irish Cup final. And so was another lad called Declan McDowell. So that was really strange to be actually playing against them when I had spent most of my time playing college football with them. So we win the game, and as a consequence, we get in to play Barcelona in a few months' time in what was known then as the European Cup Winners' Cup. So playing against Barcelona, I think that I only use about 12 words to describe it, I think, in the book. So I've been told. Actually, the goal became really important for me because, one, it was against Barcelona. to, I was nearly going to use the word catapult. I think that's a wee bit too strong. It certainly brought me into focus, I think, more with the British press at that time. I'm not saying that they were, you know, that they had every single journalist over covering this game, which they didn't have. But it got a little bit of traction, I think, in England as much as anything else. And therefore, a couple of weeks later, I get into the Northern Ireland team. A couple of players, for injury or whatever reason, didn't turn up. And instead of the manager, Terry Neal, going to get replacements in England again, which he was entitled to do, he decided to take a chance with me playing for Distillery and being a student at Queen's University. So anyway, long and the short of it, it was a great experience to be with the Northern Ireland squad for a couple of days. I get on and for the last 20 minutes against Russia at Windsor Park, never get a kick, didn't really matter. And Matt Gillies, who was the manager of Nottingham Forest at the time, was over it at the game. And he takes a chance on me the following week for £15,000. So that's how it came about. But Distillery, with those players, you know, both Catholic and Protestant in the side, was a terrific experience. And you just mentioned Jimmy McAlinden, who, without his belief in me, I think at this early stage, I think things could have gone downhill pretty quickly.
Yeah, it's obviously a big early influence on you. Must have been a great feeling to walk back into uni after scoring against Barca and represent your country as well. So
That was absolutely true. You know, walked into the Students' Union, you know, and I actually got a clap from about three or four of the lads.
Yeah, a couple of feet taller. So you talk about that journey with Jimmy McAlinden across from Belfast to Nottingham, 20th of October 1971. You've remarked about it as being a day you'll never forget as you head across to sign for Nottingham Forest. It's a place, as I mentioned, you'll spend 10 years as a player, winning a First Division title, two League Cups, two European Cups and various other pieces of silverware. But it's not until 1975 that Brian Clough arrives at the club, a man who you say changed your life forever. There's not enough words to describe Clough, I don't think, in the English language, but words like maverick, enigmatic, genius are a few that have been used over the years. But what was it about him, Martin, for you that made him just so special?
Well, first of all, he was coming into us a couple of months after he'd been sacked at Leeds United. Now he was charismatic. I mean, that's almost doing him a disfavor, really, in many aspects. He had everything. I remember in those days as well too, there weren't that many channels on television, and he was appearing on Michael Parkinson's show about every 6 or 7 weeks. You know, he was so good. I think that was actually annoying the chairman at Derby County. Long and the short of it, Brian Clough used to resign every single week at Derby. And one particular week, the chairman said, OK, fine, I'm taking it. So it came as a real surprise to Clough, I must admit, and Taylor. And anyway, they headed out of Derby. They went down to Brighton together. Brighton, it's a lovely place, I must admit, but Brighton was not the place that Brian Clough should have been. Anyway, he goes to Leeds United for 44 days. There wasn't a prayer of that ever working. Not a prayer. First of all, he called them cheats. He said they should throw their medals in the bin because they had won them dishonourably, which is incredible, really. Can you imagine telling Johnny Giles and Billy Bremner that they've actually cheated? Leeds United were by a million miles the best side in the country at the time, with the best players. And that was never going to work. It obviously knocked him back a little bit. I remember speaking to John O'Hare, who was with him at Derby, and Brian Clough took him to Leeds United in that short time he was there, and he said that he saw a different man, a man devoid of confidence, which you wouldn't ever believe about Brian Clough. But he arrives with us, we're a two-bit side, probably going nowhere. Well, that's how Clough described us anyway. And so he comes in, he is mesmeric, he is everything that you thought you saw on television, and more. And he was just, it was the way he spoke to you as much as anything else, and the way his language, I'm not saying that he was a wordsmith, actually far from it, but it was his tone of voice, it was the way he spoke. It was one of those feelings that you just felt as if you had to play for him. You were just courting his praise if you could get it. You were desperate for him to say, well done, son. But he definitely changed their lives. There's no question about that, even from day one. Despite the fact that the next 14 or 15, 16 months before his sidekick, Peter Taylor, arrived, we weren't actually moving that far. But you just felt the minute that Taylor arrived with him, a new man developed again. Cluffy regained absolutely everything that they had had. And Peter Taylor was actually brilliant for Brian Clough. And so from that minute onwards, you know, if you were as you know, you're on this sort of carousel ride and you you got to stay there with it. So by hook or by crook, I stayed there for that length of time. I think probably more by hook than anything else. But anyway, it was fantastic, and he was actually, you know, a footballing genius.
I think I'm right in saying, Martin, you're one of the few players that went on the full journey with Clough from mm-hmm. when he came in, when yeah. Forrest were in the old second division, won promotion, won the first division the next year, went on to win back-to-back European Cups, and huge, huge, huge success. There's a line you use, which I'd like to read out if you don't mind. It comes at half-time in the dressing room of the Santiago Bernabeu mm-hmm. in the final of the 1980 European Cup. He tells you you're doing brilliantly during that half-time team talk, and in the book you reflect on that with the following. I'm not expecting such high praise to come in my direction. All these years I've searched for his approval, and he waits until half-time in the European Cup final to give it. I have validation at last. What was it that made you seek out that approval from Clough for so long?
I think really it was his personality. It was his own ability. Remember, he came to Nottingham Forest. Right, he might have had a tough time at Leeds United, but that really didn't diminish his personality in any aspect. You know, you knew that something inside there was still waiting to boil over again. But he had been successful at Derby County. They'd won the league title, and they were in the semi-final of the European Cup. And I think actually that you know, there was talk about things not being proper in the game against Juventus. Mm. So in the semi-final, so he had been successful. So for him to arrive at, as I said, at our particular club was a massive coup for us. But you're talking about that to try and get that, you know, the validation. All the whole time you're kind of seeking it out. And I had many an up and down with him. You know, I used to joke and say it was concerning my ability. I used to think I was brilliant, and he wasn't so sure. But I suppose when the likes of my playing partners, like John Robertson, John used to get almost infinite praise all the time, and deservedly so. But I used to think, well, maybe they might pass this along in my direction. It might help. It might encourage me. But so I can remember the times that I got this praise in front of the rest of the players, maybe about four or five times, and one happened to be in the European Cup final. So sudden. But what it did do, it gave you a surge of energy that was incredible. We were feeling we'd scored the goal, we were leading at half time in the match, but slowly but surely Hamburg were getting the upper hand in the match. And we were feeling a little bit tired. And so suddenly for him to come into the dressing room and say, "You're doing brilliantly, son." It was like a surge of energy that goes through you. You thought, I'm ready to go again, you know? Yeah. And that's the sort of feeling that he gave, not just to me, but to everyone. Every one of us all sought his approval.
Yeah. Just a final point on that and on Brian Clough in general. Do you still feel, Martin, and this isn't from anything in the book, but do you still feel that you perhaps still sought that approval beyond your playing days under Clough? Was it something that even in later days you were keen for him to see how well you were then doing as a manager?
That's a really good point. I probably hadn't really thought about it, although I did meet him a few times, in fact. One where when I was at Leicester City, we got to the final of the League Cup, and he had retired from the game. Health-wise, I don't think he was all that fantastic. But I thought this was an opportunity, and particularly because he loved John Robertson, and I always felt as if, well, if I invite him and include John's name in it, he'll certainly come along. So we invited him to a League Cup final, and he was sat round the table, including my wife and my daughters, and my wife told me afterwards he was just fantastic. He yeah. stole the show, as you would expect, but he was really good, really, really good for the day, and I was really pleased that he came down for the match. So I can't say that I spent lots and lots of time thinking about him, but obviously moments that of reflection, you think, well, listen, I suppose, you know, in terms of management, then you started to realize when you became a manager, you started to realize what he was actually going through at the time. Less so as a player, because you're selfish. You want to know. Well, you want to know on two things as a player. I used to always say this: are you in the team, and are you getting paid? You know, I suppose. So, but as a manager, you look at it from a different perspective. You're dealing with a group of players, and somebody could come in with some sort of problem and talk to you, generally speaking, about why they weren't in the team. And yes, so I had a better understanding when I was a manager of what he had actually been going through as a manager himself.
Yeah. So you, of course, go on to win that European Cup final against Kevin Keegan's Hamburg with your great friend and View Park man, John Robertson, scoring the only goal. Your time at Forest, as I mentioned, saw you as one of the few players to go on that full journey with Brian Clough. But at that time, you know, as a player during all those glory days, did you ever consider that a life in management would be for you beyond football?
No, not really. I didn't. I remember Brian Clough actually, he came in one day, we had a team meeting, and I don't know, he was wearing his old green sweatshirt. He looked, this would have been after training, and we hadn't seen him in the morning, and I can only imagine that he must have held some sort of a board meeting or something like this here, whatever was bothering them or something bothering him. So he comes in, he wipes his brow, and goes over and gets a glass or something, a tea or whatever the case may be. And then he said to us, any of you lot, which he used to always say, any of you lot ever think about management? He said, don't. He said, because the only inevitability about this job is you'll get the sack. And he said this, and when he said it that morning, he was probably the most unsackable manager in Europe at the time. So he'd obviously must have had a tough time digging out a couple of the board members, I think, more than anything else. But you're talking about myself, about management. Didn't really enter my head at all, not even the latter stages of my playing career. In fact, I once had a conversation with Billy Bingham, who thought I thought about it, but then it didn't gather much traction at the time. Then amazingly, I meet Peter Taylor. Peter's retired from the game. He and Brian Clough had fallen out over a big incident, including John Robertson in it at the time. And they never really made up, which was actually quite sad because their partnership together was extraordinary. And so I met Peter Taylor. I didn't really want to meet him. I was trying to avoid him. I could see him coming. And he was another one who didn't really give me that much praise as a player. And I saw him coming towards me, tried to duck out of the way. And this shop, I don't know, was somewhere in Nottingham. And he said, hey, you, he said to me, and I hadn't seen him for about 5 years. He said, you disappoint me. And I said, I thought you would have gone into management. So it's actually kind of a compliment in a fashion. And he said, you had the two best teachers, Brian and myself. He said, but I'm really disappointed in you. And when I leave the conversation with him, I really started to think about it. And by the time I got home, I thought, yeah, okay. And almost that evening, any job that was becoming available, I was in doing my handwritten notes to the possible bosses of a new club. Anyways, it turns out most of the time I never got a reply back. But even so, he was the first one really to make me think about management.
And am I right in saying, did you keep some sort of diary during your early days at Forest? Was that something that you've mentioned in the book, and did you consider yourself perhaps a deeper thinker than maybe some of your teammates at that time?
No, I did not think myself as a deeper thinker. Absolutely not. No, I wouldn't have the ability to think deeply. Yes, what I normally did, and I suppose this was probably from school days, I would buy a diary for Christmas every single year and set out 1st of January, 2nd of January, and by the 4th of January, I'd given it up. Mm-hmm. And really every year. But 1972, and it was my first year at Nottingham Forest as a player, I'd come the previous October, I thought I'm going to really stick religiously to this. And I kept it going for probably a couple of months. And I came across it a few years ago, and honestly, it's so puerile. It's really untrue.
I'd love to see it.
It is desperate. You don't want to see it, honestly. I've got a granddaughter now who will be 4 in February, and seriously, she would laugh at this stuff, you know, and she would be writing better stuff. It was, you know, pathetic stuff, like
from a published author, no less.
Yeah. I kind of must do better. Blamed everybody, you know. Manager, why is he not picking me in the side, you know? And well, probably a really good reason, because you've been rubbish the last 3 weeks. It was very much like that there. But do you know what it did do? But I was more interested really in who was in the charts at the time. So it's actually, I've got about 3 or 4 lines about my footballing time, and the rest about who's moving up the charts with like Badfinger, a really, really good song at the time. Nielsen, Without You, which was actually written by the two lads from Badfinger as well too. Mm-hmm. So all of this news. So I was more interested in the music scene than I was in my football, which, you know, actually considering this was my career, I should have been the other way around.
Maybe so. There's lots of musical references actually, Martin. One that stood out to me is when you mentioned that tragically Joe Dolce's Shut Up Your Face as number one instead of as Ultravox at the
absolutely
time?
Vienna. Yeah, absolutely. How could that be? I
mean, tragedy.
And I said, absolutely. I said, there's nothing fair in the world after that, you know.
The reason that one stands out for me is because February 81 was when I was born.
So, and that is that right?
Joe Dolce was number one when I was born, so it stood out for me.
No, you're kidding.
That line.
Oh, very good.
But anyway,
very good.
Enough music, let's move back to football. So after leaving the City ground as a player in 1981, you've got spells with Norwich, Man City, back to Norwich, I think, and then even Notts County. And it's a county where a knee injury sustained in February 85 brings to an end your playing days. As you mentioned, you then write to a number of clubs and no replies or some Dear John letters come back in the post, but you eventually, after coming through the non-league route, you have great days at Wycombe Wanderers. I think still at time of recording, their most successful manager ever. You win two FA trophies and get them into the Football League for the very first time in their history. A brief spell at Norwich then follows, but it's Leicester where you really make your mark in the top flight, winning promotion at the Premiership as well as two League Cups. But Celtic then come calling in summer of 2000. Can you tell us, first of all, how that came to be?
It was the summer of 2000. Leicester had just won the League Cup. We were back in Europe again and we'd finished in the top 10. And I was really enjoying my time at Leicester, genuinely enjoying it after, you know, pretty torrid opening. Life was really good and I'd won over the fans and it was excellent. And then I'm travelling down the road. I get a call on a mobile phone. I remember the mobile phones in those days, you know, about a foot and a half long. So, and it was Sir Alex Ferguson on the phone saying that would I have any interest in managing Celtic? And I said, absolutely. And he said, because he was very friendly with Dermot Desmond. Dermot Desmond had asked Alex, who would he recommend? And Sir Alex recommended about three people. And Dermot, of the three that he'd recommended, including myself, Dermot went for me. It was, certainly went in terms of an interview. So he said, would you take a call from Dermot in about half an hour's time? I said, absolutely. So I'm still travelling. And Dermot calls, would I meet him and the board the following night in London? That I did. And for the first time ever, I must have done all right in an interview stage. And I get the job. And so coming up to Celtic, to sign for Celtic at the time, was just extraordinary. Never forget, you know, that evening when everything had all died down and even the crowd outside had dispersed, and still a moment or two to think about it. So a race up to the very top of the Jock Stein stand, just have a look at the empty stadium and you think, wow, whoa, this is something really special. And I know it sounds rather sycophantic now, but it wasn't meant to be. And you thought it would be nice. Now, obviously, the stadium had changed greatly from Jock Stein's days, but and I remember that the old truck coming in, you know, when they'd just won the European Cup. So those thoughts and that, you know, trying to picture where that old truck would have pulled into, you know, and, yeah, and the track around it. But the stadium at Celtic Park was just pretty special.
The section of the book on Celtic starts with a really amazing quote from the barber, no less.
Yeah.
So for all those who don't know, the barber is Martin's dad, Leo. That was the nickname in the town. If you ever get a chance to play for Celtic, son, take it immediately and don't even stop to think. Now, you mentioned that Celtic scouted you briefly, I think, during your playing days at Distillery, but that wasn't to be. Coming from your background, Martin, in Northern Ireland, what was the sense of pride like for you, your dad, your family, when you finally got the chance to make a mark on Celtic's history?
Well, it's funny, really, because my father was a barber in Kilray, and obviously from our background, Irish nationalist Catholic. But even so, a lot of Protestants came to him as well, too, because my father had a very, very open mind, really. Interestingly, and I'd say this, sometimes Celtic players would come to Northern Ireland for their holidays, their summer holidays in Port Stewart and Port Rush, which is only about 20 miles away. And sometimes in those days, there was little seven-a-side competitions or five-a-side competitions as well too. And some of the Celtic players would play in these competitions. So, and one or two, way back in the 50s, come in and got their hair cut with my father. So not that my father needed that there, to, you know, to be a Celtic fan, but he was. And he also had a massively big picture of the Busby Babes as well in the barbershop window, which I eventually took down. And sorry, now I lost it, but it was really amazing picture. And even though he had been one of the co-founders of the Gaelic team in Kilray, he really did have a really open mind. But anyway, his thoughts were on Celtic, and that as I was growing up and starting to show a bit of ability, my father used to think that it would be great to play for Celtic. When I was at Distillery, a Celtic scout did come over to the game. I must have been really poor, and got overlooked. And I remember meeting the great Jock Stein quite some years later. I was at Nottingham Forest at the time, and we met in Ireland. He was over to present some prizes in a thing during the summer. And I met him, and he was really gracious, overly gracious, really, when I mentioned that I mustn't have played too well. He wouldn't have remembered, you know, wouldn't have known. The scouts were going out to watch loads and loads of players. Mm-hmm. And so I just said, I'm afraid I didn't play well that day, because the local paper had mentioned that there was a Celtic scout coming that day. Whether that scout turned up or not, I don't know, but I think he did. And I certainly, I remember that day anyway, because I'd scored twice in the first 7 minutes and then never got a kick after that. Never got a kick.
Maybe they were 15 minutes late and missed your
Yes, I hadn't even thought about that. Yes, exactly.
What could have been? So as I say, you come in the door at Celtic Park as manager in summer 2000, and first task is overcoming a 20-point lead or a 20-point margin that Rangers had won the league by in the previous season. You managed to overcome that and then some by winning a treble in your first season at Celtic. This includes a 6-2 hammering of Rangers in your first Old Firm game and numerous big displays from guys like Henrik Larsson, Chris Sutton, Paul Lambert, Stelian Petrov and Neil Lennon. And all those players and others captained the club at some point or other during their time at Celtic, and many have then gone on to become manager. Do you feel, Martin, it was really important for you to ensure you had leaders throughout your team? And aside from the obvious candidates in terms of Larsson and Sutton, for example, are there any unsung heroes from your time at the club that are maybe lesser spoken of?
A couple of points there. First of all, Mark Viduka wanted to leave the football club, a very, very fine, talented player. He wanted to leave in that summer of 2000, and I tried to persuade him for a phone call that I had with him to stay, but he had made his mind up. So there was an offer from Leeds United in for £6 million. We turned the money over to Chris Sutton, and even though I don't give Chris the credit in the book that he deserves, he was a genuine landscape changer for us. Let me put it this way now, when I think about it, if he had not arrived at the time, if let's say he had arrived about 5 or 6 weeks later after the Old Firm game, we may not have won that match, mm-hmm. and things might have been different. And he came in at the time, he had a point to prove, I think, himself. You know, he had been brilliant at Blackburn Rovers along with Alan Shearer, and then not so great at Chelsea. Point to prove, wanting to do it. Probably wanting to get out of London as much as anything else, but his partnership with Henrik Larsson was absolutely a proper force, really. And then I was able to add some players as well to. Didier Agat came in for £50,000. Alan Thompson did brilliantly for 2.5. Jos Valgaren came in, changing Johan Malby from a centre midfield player to a centre back. All of those things. But if you're asking about someone that I felt was was a really good player. It took me a little bit of time to realise how good a player he was. And I don't know why this did, because I'm generally a half reasonable judge of a player. It was Jackie McNamara.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. McNamara, baby-faced assassin, you know, could stick the shoe in. That's an old Irish phrase, I must admit. McNamara, brave lad. Scared of nothing, absolutely nothing. Could play right back, could play right side midfield, could play centre midfield if he wanted to as well too. And perhaps maybe sometimes a line that Ian Bowyer of Nottingham Forest used to say, when Ian could play a number of positions, he said then when everybody's fit, he's generally the one that's left out. And maybe that there might have been an element of that. Hopefully it's not, but it took me a little bit of time. But McNamara was really a terrific player. And underrated, and if he was underrated at the time at Celtic, that's maybe as much my fault as anything else. But the more I think about it, the more I thought, I since apologised to him profusely a number of times, whether he's accepted or not, but he was terrific, absolutely terrific player.
And also went on to be a manager, had good success at Dundee United and then maybe some mixed success elsewhere. I've mentioned that group of players, Henrik Larsson's been a manager, mixed success, Sutton, not so much at Lincoln, Lambert, very successful, and of course Neil Lennon, and you do speak glowingly about Neil in the book and the pivotal part he played across your career, both at Leicester and when he joined you up at Celtic. Was he someone you always felt was, of course, a natural leader, but someone that may go on to success in management?
Well, you mentioned a couple of points, sorry, and I didn't cover one. And you were talking about, did you sign leaders? the bigger the personality, the better for me. I felt this. Like, for instance, Paul Lambert was at the football club. Paul was very influential in the dressing room, really influential, really good footballer. I, again, perhaps maybe sometimes underestimate it as well. Good, strong influence and good, strong, positive influence, even when maybe occasionally, maybe not in the side, probably as much to do with his age as anything else. Maravchik was a sensational footballer, best two-footed player I've ever worked with. And I wish he had been 27. If he had been 27 when I arrived at the football club, I honestly think that we would be toasting Seville as a victory. That's my point. But you talk about Neil Lennon. Lennon was everything that you would want. I signed him twice. I signed him from Crewe Alexander to Leicester City, where he did everything for us, a proper leader. And he was very seldom captain at both Leicester and at Celtic for me. But in many aspects, he took on that mantle. And really, in the dressing room, as much as anything else, and I said this in a joking fashion, the first 5 minutes in the dressing room at halftime was generally separating him and Bobo Baldy and people like this. So the bigger the character, I didn't mind. I felt as if I could handle these players. It didn't really matter. John Hartson came in my second year, big character as well. So really, you know, I had enough confidence in myself to be able to deal with these people, even if they put up some sort of an argument on during the course of the game. And Lenny would put up a number of arguments at the time. I'd have to just tell him to keep quiet for a moment or two, you know. But it genuinely didn't bother me at all. And the bigger the character, I felt as if that they could deal with situations on the pitch then better, as long as they had my backing behind them, and which I think for most of the time I did. Well, actually all of the time.
Yeah. You mentioned that Jimmy McLendon at the Distillery, he wasn't averse to the players having a bit of a dust up and sorting things out amongst himself on a semi-frequent basis. I was going to say, without naming names, mm-hmm. Was that something that would happen from time to time with such big characters in a Celtic dressing room?
You thought I was joking there a moment or two ago. Not at all. The players, particularly if things were not going well, you know, half time could be really a sorting out. But the time that you start to talk even remotely tactical about the game, it was actually sorting out certain angry moments, you know. And sometimes, like Stillian Petra was a very young lad, very, very young, and I took a big liking to Stillian, you know. Thought he was a terrific footballer. And because he was young, sometimes I felt early on, before he really looked after himself, that he might be picked upon, you know. So I was always trying to defend him all the time. I that was the one thing I couldn't have, is that a big player is trying to pick on somebody a bit younger because they think that they could win the argument over. So I always took the side of the underdog until that underdog became the big player himself. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Neil Lennon would be generally having a go at something at halftime, you know. And it was a matter of just trying to separate that. You wouldn't really want to get into an argument with Bobo Baldy too often, you know, really, because Bobo didn't say that much. But when he did speak in staccato language, you know, you had to listen to him.
Yeah.
And Henrik probably not so much, but Henrik would have a say as well too. And yes, he would. He would have a say occasionally. Sometimes I disagreed with him.
Sometimes. So going back to that first season, Martin, the treble season, aside from the 6-2 result, obviously that's the kind of standout moment for so many fans and a dawning on Celtic fans who, out with the success in 1998, had gone through about 10 years of torture, more or less. And we obviously seen that as such a huge moment and potentially a big turning point. But was there any other pivotal moments or games within that season where you yourself knew that the team were onto something special?
I do mention in the book where, you know, that was the game, the big 6-2 game was fantastic. And the more I think about it now, or the more that Celtic fans of that vintage tell me about it, yeah, it was a really big moment. For me, winning the game was great because it gave us confidence to know to take on the rest of the season. And by the time that that Rangers turned us over big time in November at Ibrox, they were too powerful for us. They were too strong. They were aggressive, and they scored from set pieces. And they were just they honestly bullied us all afternoon. But even so, and then a couple of days later, we only draw against Hibs as well. So we've now dropped five points, and we've picked up the 1 point from the two games. And you could think then maybe that the wheels might come off at that stage. But I genuinely felt there was enough confidence about the team to, you know, gather ourselves together again and kick on. And we really did kick on. I think from the next game, I think we were a goal behind, crowd really, really rose to the occasion that day. And I think Lubo scored an equaliser and we carried on. If that game had gone again and maybe even dropped points at Celtic Park, it might have been a long way back. So those things are pivotal during the course of the time. Don't seem to be at that particular stage, but the more you look back on them. But by the time that Christmas had come up in that season, we were really on a roll. You know, we genuinely felt invincible.
Yeah. In the following season, so domestic success, absolutely, winning a treble in your first year, the first treble since 1969 under Dirk Steen, I think.
Amazing, that.
Unbelievable stat. But the following season, we're back in Europe competing to take a place in the Champions League for the first time and managed to beat European big hitters Ajax. So we win 3-1 away from home. Didier Gat, huge game for him. Mm-hmm. Bobby Petter, Chris Sutton, brilliant goals. Win 3-1 there, and I think we lose 1-0 back at Celtic Park, but we're okay and we make it through to the group stages. And was it at this stage, Martin, that you realised that this team maybe had something more than just domestic success in front of them?
I think that the game in Ajax where we were really terrific, and I think we surprised Ajax that particular night. And the second game, as you mentioned, we were nervous. Gosh, that was just the manager, and I think it was just because we had been so brilliant in Amsterdam. If we lose this here, this would be desperate. So we were very nervous during the course of the match, and just to see the game through was good enough. Then we were in the groups. We were into the Champions League proper. I think the first game that we were down, we were going to be playing at home, but 9/11 had happened at that stage, you know, and so there was postponements. So our first game was actually in the Stadio dell'Alpi, I think it was, for against Juventus. 2-0 down, I think we got back to 2-2. We conceded a penalty in the last minute, which is just ridiculous, really ridiculous. And even that point would have been enough for us to go through in the group. And you never know, when you're into the knockout stages, who knows? But to get 9 points in the group that time and not come out of the group was really disappointing. But yeah, I started to think that, you know, that European football is where Celtic are going to be judged at, you know, that the Old Firm are judged in European football as much as anything else. And because of the great success away back under Jock Steen and everything else, you know, you try and align yourself alongside that there, or try and, very, very difficult. But that's where you should be aiming for all the time. But I felt that we had a side capable of dealing with European football. They were still pretty young. They're still naive in many aspects. But I never really wanted to use that as an excuse. And I never for 1 minute did I ever say to the players, oh, next year will be better. We'll be better next year. No, it was for the moment. You've got to live for that moment. And you can't, next year might be totally different. You might not even be as good. So every moment was the one that you pick it up from that and you go with it. And you deal with it that particular evening. Doesn't matter. You're competing against some of the best sides in Europe, but that doesn't matter. You are good. You're really good yourselves, and you've got to believe in it. And I think that was the sort of message you tried to convey to the players. But sometimes I don't even think that they needed that message. I think they started to really believe in themselves.
Yeah. And the following year, so after the first Champions League campaign, the following year we fall short against FC Basel of Switzerland. Big disappointment. But I believe you mentioned that Stylian Petrov's the man in the dressing room that after the disappointment starting to lift from the players, mm-hmm. he says, we'll just need to go and win this UEFA Cup now. And that's galvanised the team. And we obviously got so close to doing so. Seville, May 2003. I don't need to get into the finer details of the game itself and what played out, but certainly a special but also a bittersweet moment for Celtic and their supporters that night. In the book, you mentioned some of the big disappointments in your sporting career, Martin. This includes losing with St Malachy's in the final of the Hogan Cup at Croke Park, and also not being fit enough to take your place in the lineup for the 1979 mm-hmm. European Cup final. Obviously a huge moment in your career. Where does Seville rank amongst all of that?
I think Seville would be top of the list. Yeah, absolutely. It was to do with you're in a final. You're in the final of the UEFA Cup. It would be a trophy. It would be the first European trophy since Jock Steen's days. That would have been fantastic for us. And not for 1 minute would we start to compare ourselves with the 67 side. That was European Cup, and that was the first British side ever to win the European Cup. Sensational. And but really to win the trophy, to take that back, and particularly on that evening as well too, with 75,000 Celtic fans descending upon Seville, not one arrest during the proceedings, and for people still to come up to me now and was saying I was at Seville. It's still one of the great days of my life. I think probably maybe they might mean the journey to Seville as much as anything else. Their own particular journals, geographically getting there, and their own journeys in terms of the matches that were played during that time, Blackburn Rovers and Liverpool coming to mind immediately. But yeah, really, that would be top disappointment in football.
Yeah, I was in Seville. I'll never forget it, but I still can't watch that game back. It's just,
absolutely, it's just not too at all. Much.
Just as we're starting to close things out, Martin, two quick fire questions, if you don't mind. One, if there was one decision you could make differently from your time at Celtic, what would that be?
One decision to make differently. Ah, heaven's sake. It does make me laugh, you know, when people are talking about their lives and say, have you any regrets? And they all say, well, no, they don't. Well, no, sorry, I've got about 15,000. And that's just for the one day. Well, if you could turn the clock back, yeah, I would maybe, much as we needed him, maybe with Bobo Baldy being on a yellow card, going into extra time, sometimes, you know, Bobo would... you could be a bit reckless in many aspects. You might think about maybe taking him off in the game because it was going to go into penalties. I wouldn't be sure that Bobo might score one for you. So that's been unfair, really, in many aspects. But if you really start to think at the time, then perhaps that's the case in Bobo, and the game might go to penalties and we might win it. I'd never really thought about the penalty kicks. All the time I'm thinking we've only won it before penalties because we had a penalty shootout, I think, against Valencia a couple of years ago. Didn't go so well. So I wasn't worried. And then when Bobo does get sent off in the game, you think, well, maybe we will take a chance with penalties because there's not that long left. But in sliding doors moments, I think, if you're talking about it, if you're, you know, if things to do over again, there'd be two. We would win the UEFA Cup, and we would win the we'd have beaten Motherwell in the game in my last season there. So those are two big moments where you're really proud of a team. Seville, the conditions, the extra time, everything, and we have to come back and try and score a load of goals against Kilmarnock on the following Sunday when we have got almost zero energy, you know, and the players come on and perform like the way they did as well too, and for us to lose the league by a goal or something like that there, that was tough to take. So overall, some fantastic memories, obviously, some moments you'd love to change, yeah, and if there's moments about taking players off or on, yeah it would be. Not one specific thing. Please don't hold up that Bobo thing as a case, because he'll get to hear about it and he will make his way back and he will be very angry with me. Only joking. So, I'm sure that there are loads of things, not just at Celtic, but at other football clubs. When I was at Aston Villa, for instance, we were in the League Cup final against Manchester United. We had a goal. We got a penalty in the first minute of the match or second minute of the game. Vidic, Manchester United centre-half, should have been sent off the pitch. Wasn't sent off, stayed on the pitch. The referee made up his own rules in the game, and probably because he saw Alex Ferguson staring at him greatly, I don't know. But so that's a moment then you think to yourself you could change, because we could have won that cup with the energy that we had in the team and the running power we had with Villa. That would have been nice. So yes, there's, you know, If I could keep going for another 3 hours, I might come to something really positive.
I think we've covered all 15,000 that you'd mentioned. Finally, Martin, final question. If you can sum up your time at Celtic in one or two lines, how would you do so?
That's extraordinary. A real privilege to manage the football club. Genuine privilege to be in charge of the time that I had. And for people still to talk about Seville as being a great experience. Obviously, we've lost the game. To me, it hurts really badly. Still will do until I'm finished in this planet. And what extraordinary time. Loved it. And really probably summed up by my wife, who thought that this was the most beautiful time in my managerial time. She loved it. She loved Glasgow as a place. And so if she enjoyed it, yeah, it must have been okay.
Yeah, and a great place for us to finish off for today, Martin. Martin, thanks for being so kind with your time and for sharing some stories of a life in football with us here at the Celtic Exchange. It goes without saying that we wish you every success with the book on days like these. And if it's anything like the success you had throughout your football career, then a new life as an author surely awaits. Thanks,
thank
Martin.
You. No, thank you very much indeed.
Social Podcast Network.